State of opportunity.
State of opportunity.
I want to be a firefighter.
A ballerina.
I want to be a Batman.
This is State of Opportunity from Michigan Radio. I'm Dustin Dwyer. Last week, I brought you a story on the theory of white fragility, which was developed by Robin DiAngelo. DiAngelo developed her theory after years of both leading and observing workshops on racism. Her original paper on it runs 17 pages long. She also wrote a book called What Does It Mean to Be White? And she has a PhD. She's been doing this work for 2 decades. We had about 5 minutes to tell you the story on our air. And since then, we've gotten a lot of comments, many people looking for more context. Some people went ahead and read DiAngelo's paper on white fragility, which is linked to in our original story. But there's also a lot more to my interview with Robin DiAngelo than what we were able to share on the radio. So now we want to bring you the extended interview, which runs about 45 minutes long. And a reminder, if you can't listen at your computer, you can download this interview as a podcast and take it with you. Just search for State of Opportunity on iTunes. This extended interview begins with DiAngelo telling me about the focus of her work today, leading racism workshops in the nonprofit sector in Seattle and doing consulting work.
All of my focus is really on race, racism, and with a particular kind of specialty on whiteness and what I think of as everyday white racism, the kind that good, nice white progressives like you and I inevitably have.
Okay, great. So tell me this story. How does one get into the study of whiteness?
Well, for me, it started when I graduated from college and didn't really know what I could do for a living. And I came across a job for a diversity trainer. And I really thought that my qualifications were that I was, you know, open-minded, vegetarian, you know, drove a Prius, and that that's all it took, you know, to be qualified to lead other people in essentially what I saw as open-mindedness. And I was in for the most profound learning of my entire life on every possible level. And the first level was in no way did my so-called open-mindedness prepare me to engage with any depth or complexity on race or racism. And also I was working with interracial teams. And so I was working with people of color, you know, day in and day out who were challenging my racial worldview. I wouldn't have even been able to told you I had a racial worldview, much less ever had a sustained challenge to it. So that was another level. And then going out into the workplace to do mandatory diversity training and the depth of the hostility and the resistance from primarily white audiences. And this went on for years. And over time, I got stronger, I got clearer, and I got more able to articulate how we pull it off, what I think of as how white people pull off this deep investment in racism, you know, living in segregation while proclaiming that race has no meaning to us. And I wanted to apply that, you know, be able to disseminate that at a larger level. So I went on to get my doctorate in this emerging field called whiteness studies. So for a very long time, people of color have been pushing white people to stop focusing on us and how to deal with us and look at yourselves, because it's a relationship. And so finally, white folks started doing that. And that's where that field emerged.
I'm wondering if you can walk me through a bit how does this form this how do white people grow up in a world where they just don't see their own whiteness, and where does it start?
It happens from the moment we're born. Racism is a system. It's the system of our society. It's the default, and we're born into it. And from the time we open our eyes, we are conditioned to see whiteness or whites as superior and people of color as inferior. It's happening 24/7 through the images that we're given, through the stories that we're told and not told, through our schools, our teachers, the media, through our preference for segregation, through the inability to receive constructive and complex knowledge about race and racism. And so we get to this adult phase, and we're fundamentally ignorant about race. There is no way to... Okay, let me back up and say this a different way. All of us as white folks by the time we're adults, have opinions and perspectives on race and racism. In fact, I've never met a white person who didn't have an opinion on race and racism, and usually a very emotionally held opinion. And yet, if we just gained our opinions from living our lives, following the trajectories laid out for us in schools and in our families and in our kind of social interactions, we will necessarily be ignorant about race and racism, because the dominant society simply does not provide us with the information we need, and certainly not in any sustained way. In fact, there's social penalty for whites who try to speak up about racism. And so all of that keeps us kind of in this insular obliviousness. It's an obliviousness that's actively negotiated. I mean, it's kind of a willful ignorance. It's not as if it's not in front of us, but we work really hard not to see it because it serves us not to see it. And I know I said a lot right there, and so you can pull out any piece of that you want me to say more about.
Yeah, well, I guess what I really wanted to ask was, like, what do white people say when you tell them this?
Over the years, I've learned how to be really proactive, and I get away with it for a few reasons. The first one is that I'm white, and there's a way in which I can say, look, I know this, you know this, come on, we know, and it's undeniable. If a person of color tries to say the things that I say, it just doesn't go well, and they're dismissed as biased or whatever. But when a white person is speaking to fellow white people and speaking in kind of the language we're socialized into, it's very difficult to deny. And I usually have the time to unfold it, right? To kind of start with the foundation of, you know, I mean, what is socialization? Most people are taught that human beings can be objective, or at least white human beings can be objective, that we can, you know, speak for humanity, that, you know, we have the universal human experience. And so you have to start with, you know, what is socialization? How does it work? And then what's the difference between prejudice and discrimination and oppression? What does it mean to say that oppression is prejudice, a group's prejudice and discrimination backed by institutional power? And so we kind of go step by step. And in my mind, I'm thinking, okay, will you go here with me? Okay, how about here? How about here? How about here? Little by little, before you know it, you're out here and being able to grapple with what I just said. I also use a lot of images from popular culture that illustrate everything that I'm talking about. And one image in particular, this isn't so much from popular culture, but it's a metaphor that was turning around in my head. As I listened to people over and over and over, white people repeat the most predictable and meaningless platitudes, right? I don't see color. People just need to, if only, you know, these kind of one sentence answers. And I had this image of a dock just floating on the water, right? And it looks like it's just floating there. And that's all that superficial surface stuff. And in order for me to figure out how we can say these things and live so profoundly separated by race, I had to go underneath the dock and look at the pillars that are holding it up. What are our basic beliefs or ideologies that allow us to make these claims even as we live in segregation? And that segregation is only increasing. And that, of course, just assumes that's all we're doing. But, of course, within that segregation, we're all exposed to stories and jokes and omissions and warnings. And right. So it's a very active segregation. Right. It's a very racially active segregation. But we're taught to see race as only present if people of color are present. So it's very complex. But when you go underneath and you look at that, the foundations, the number one most effective adaptation of racism over time is the good bad binary. This idea that a racist is a bad person and a good person is not racist. And that so it's about individuals who are either good or bad, or who either do or don't engage. And if I'm an individual who's not aware of engaging, or I, of course, believe that it's not right to engage, then I have nothing to do with racism and I'm exempt. Right? That binary is also what makes it almost impossible to talk to white people about racism, because all of our energy goes to deflecting any association, because what we hear is, you are immoral. Once I understood that racism was a system, it was the water in which we swim, it's the water in which I was born into, being good or bad is irrelevant, there is no exemption from it, then I could let go of, you know, the fear of looking at it within myself and start examining it and actually appreciate being able to see it, because I don't want to collude with it. But the default is racism, which means if you just live your life the way it's set up, you will reproduce it. Our schools reproduce it. Our media reproduces it. Apathy reproduces it. Segregation reproduces it. So I'm able to really lay that out and, you know, show those images. And generally, people are kind of blown away and they're able to see something they weren't able to see before. You know, and it took me years and years and years to figure out how to do it. But I'm confident that I'm fairly effective at it at this point.
So it works?
Most of the time, yeah.
So how did you come up, we're going to skip around here a bit, but I want to, like, this idea of white fragility, the concept of white fragility, how did you come across that? How did you sort of formulate that idea and even start calling it that?
Yeah. I wrote a note. I'm going to go to that. I do want to say one more thing about when you said, does it work? It works at the time that I'm doing it. But what I always say to the people in the room is, absolutely nothing outside this room will support you to continue to see what we just saw in here. In fact, the forces will conspire to keep you from seeing this. So you have to figure out how you're going to sustain this awareness, because it one time will not enable you to keep it up, right? That it's ongoing, lifelong, and it takes a profound commitment, because there's a lot of social resistance and penalty to trying to maintain your awareness of this. So as far as white fragility, those of us in the field that I'm in talk a lot about resistance, right? How do we cope with resistance from those who benefit from the particular form of oppression that we're dealing with at a given time? So when I do workshops, we look at a whole range of oppressions, but my area of specialty and expertise and passion is whiteness. And it is helpful to think about it as resistance and how to be proactive, but also this... just watching people literally fall apart and not be able to sustain any challenge to their racial worldviews, and that the strategies we use to deflect that challenge, just I started thinking about it about as how fragile our sensibilities are when it comes to race, that we live in an environment that insulates us and protects us from ever having to be challenged or stressed about race. We walk through the world with a sense of belonging. Any space deemed valuable in society, I belong as a white person. I don't carry the psychic burden of race. I'm given the privilege of being viewed as an individual. 24/7, I am racially comfortable. It is a rare exception for me not to be comfortable, and I can easily avoid that. And nothing I just said a person of color could say in this society. And so we just haven't had to build our stamina to endure challenges to that. And to be honest, we're also invested in it because it serves us. So you have both this lack of stamina and this deep investment, and this compulsion to deny that any of that is happening because it would mean that we were bad people. And all of that makes us pieces of work for people of color, crazy making for people of color, makes us irrational, it makes us bullies in a form in these conversations. And yet it's not purely irrational, because it works beautifully to protect our position and our privilege.
And I'm wondering, I think when I was reading your work, I think there are kind of two kinds of white people that we're talking about.
Okay.
tell me if I'm describing this in a way that you see it. But there's the one kind of problem which I imagine is the man you wrote about, is red faced, banging on the desk, mm-hmm. who's just like, no, we can't get any jobs. And there's the other that you said was more of, you know, you and my probably type of white person. So I wonder if we can take them one by one, if you do think that this is a decent classification system. For one, I wondered how that story ended with that man. Did that man come around? I wonder if you could just sort of tell that story and how it ended.
Yeah, that was in the early days. And to be honest, I was like a deer in headlights when I started. Like I said, I was just this well-meaning, completely clueless white liberal. And those were the kind of encounters I was having day in and day out. And I was just paralyzed in the face of them. I found that intimidating. You know, you have an angry white man pounding his fist. So I had my own visceral reaction to it, my lack of articulation, because, again, I've never had to think about this or articulate any kind of counter argument to it. And at the same time, I was having enough experiences that allowed me to step back and also kind of watch and think about what is going on, and looking out at the room in which he was pounding his fist. And there was a glass wall, you know, that you could look through and see the main office, you know, with all the cubicles. And as I looked out there, I saw all these white people, and I saw all these white people in the room that he was pounding his fist in, all of them employed. And so it was unnerving. It was like, this is not rooted in any racial reality that is happening in this room, in this workplace, or in this man's life. And yet, these feelings are real. His rage is real. How do we do that? How do we pull that off? And that's what got me focused on just trying to figure out. And I had to go under the surface and think about what are the fundamental beliefs that lead us to this place.
So how do you reach that person?
Okay. Oh, and so I doubt that I reached that person, particularly at that point in my own growth around these issues. And I may not ever reach that person. What I have behind my name today, you know, I call upon whatever strategies will work. So I have a PhD. I'll call upon that. I have a confidence that's very different than what I had there. I have a kind of an authority, and I use all of it. And I'm probably more effective with people like that. I would probably be more direct with him. I would probably do a little timeout motion with my hand and say, teachable moment. Let's look at what's going on. I might talk to him offline. There are a lot of things I would do today that would probably at least move it a little further. And that leads us to the question you asked about kind of two categories of white people. And I don't mind thinking about it that way, as long as we don't think of one category as racist and one category as less racist. I think it just manifests differently. And so there's the explicit racist. And I can tell you that after the interview in Alternet came out, I got some jaw-droppingly ugly and hateful emails. And those are not the kind of people I'm trying to reach. That's explicit racism. They're not in denial about it. I'm trying to reach the average well-intended white person who is complicit with racism without any kind of awareness and with a lot of denial that's happening. So for me, the question is not, is it or isn't it racism? The question is, how is racism manifesting in this particular situation? Because it is 24/7 in our society. It's 24/7. So the question changes, right? When you understand that, you ask different questions, and that allows you to see a very different social dynamics.
Well, how does that conversation go then?
Which one?
With a second category, like say a person is one of these people who's like, oh, you know, I sometimes like to refer to these as soft-eyed white people like me who like the subject of racism comes up and is just kind of like, yeah, that's so bad. You know, it's really rough. We got to work really hard on that, you know, and that's sort of where the conversation ends.
Yeah. Well, I've gotten better at asking questions and trying to make a point without being really direct. Sometimes you need to be direct. But I might say, so tell me how you see it manifesting in your life. Or, so what kinds of things have you done to challenge that? And just wait. Just ask that question and wait. And keep going.
Yeah. I guess that gets me to, like, I'm wondering if there are, like, more strategies that you can give people. Like, obviously, the work that you do is intense, and you have sometimes days with people. But I imagine you're also sometimes in social situations where you're just talking to someone for a few minutes, or you're at a party or something, and people are like, well, what do you do? Do you have a list of, like, tips that you give out? Like, here's how to have meaningful conversation about race as a white person with other white people?
There are many patterns of whiteness. That's how I think about them. They're just patterns, but the patterns basically prove the rule. There are exceptions to all patterns, but I'm very comfortable generalizing about white people, in part because it interrupts the precious ideology of individualism. So that right there is an interruption to one of the linchpins of racism. And one of the patterns is to want to jump to solutions. And of course, part of being white is a lack of humility, a kind of arrogance that we could determine whether something is racist or not racist. And this wanting to jump over and into just tell me what to do and pass over all the really hard personal work. And so I would try to get that person to not focus on how do I tell so-and-so that they're, you know, colluding with racism, but to focus on what does it look like in you and in your life. And though it may be hard to hear, this immediately going to how do I talk to other white people is part of what it looks like. That's separating ourselves from this. So I would try to put them back. You know, we can get there, but I think the more complexity you can see in how it works in you and in your own life, the more complex your responses will be to other people.
And can we break out just one thing that one, I guess, discussion topic that that I see a lot that I think you mentioned earlier, this idea that some white people hold that well, if I just don't think about it and if I don't talk about it and if I don't say racist things, then I'm not racist. And the more you keep bringing it up, the more it's becoming a problem. And it's really like the more we talk about it, the more it's a problem.
Well, this is where, you know, I have the key question of how does that function? So I might ask the person, so how do you see not talking about racism functioning within a society in which racism is embedded?
And how does that typically go? Like what kind of responses you get from that?
Well, you might get a defensive response, but you just kind of have to keep trying and keep going. And I have found that sometimes people are not immediately going to shift, or they need to save face and they can't do it in front of you. But I have had people come back to me and say, you know, you planted a seed, or I kept thinking about it. And so you also have to be patient and remember that some of this is for you too. For us as white people to speak up about this is also an interruption to our privilege of silence, right? Our apathy about challenging racism, our lack of interest about challenging racism, right? So, you know, you can do it for yourself too. Build your own skills. You know, you'll have plenty of opportunities to, you know, make another mistake with somebody because racism's everywhere.
Yeah, that kind of gets to something that I feel like is another big roadblock that a lot of times white people don't speak up about race just because the thing that white people fear most is being called a racist. And like almost every discussion I've had about race with another white person, that comes up at one point or another. Someone has to explicitly say, well, I'm not a racist, but, you know, or whatever.
Well, that gets back to why I said the most effective adaptation of racism over time has been this idea that racists are bad, right? So prior, you know, civil rights era, it was fairly socially acceptable for white people to just come out and say, yes, we're superior. You know, my father certainly felt comfortable saying that. That was the big joke around Archie Bunker, right? But post-civil rights, it's no longer as acceptable to say that. in public spaces, right? We say it behind closed doors, but not publicly. And that seems like a positive change, right? That it's now racism's bad. But what that did was make it impossible for anyone to look at their own racism or to look at themselves, right? Because we set it up as about good and bad people or about an issue of morality rather than about a system. It's so effective. Almost any defensiveness that you get from a white person trying to talk about racism is rooted in that good-bad binary. They hear you saying you are a bad person.
Right.
When we're at the dinner table and Uncle Bob says that thing at Thanksgiving and everybody freezes and nobody says anything, right? And they tell you later, well, we didn't want to ruin the dinner. That dynamic right there, why would the dinner be ruined? The dinner would be ruined because Uncle Bob would get defensive and then people would have to either side or defend Uncle Bob. You know, all of that is rooted in this idea that you just told Uncle Bob he was a bad person.
Right, and you feel like you're not really going to change Uncle Bob anyway, so.
Yes, but I would also say, and who does that serve and what does that serve? I want to change the culture so that the Uncle Bobs feel uncomfortable rather than the five passive white people sitting there enduring and you know, implicitly condoning what Uncle Bob says in order to avoid some upset from Uncle Bob. You see, this is how effective white fragility is. It bullies us into silence. So we also have to build our stamina to endure people's upset around challenging racism.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And when the media definitely sets racism up in this way too, right? So-and-so, you know, Paula Deen, she said this thing. Is she or isn't she racist? Call in and give your opinion, which of course is a whole nother area that the lack of humility we have, white people have about their opinions on racism. In other words, we're the least likely to be able to see it. We're invested in not seeing it, and yet it's up to us to say whether it's legitimate or not. But that's kind of an aside, right? So is she or isn't she a racist? And of course, she's going to insist that she isn't. And then people are going to get on the news and testify that she's a good person. She couldn't be racist. I know her. She's a good person. Because a good person and a racist are mutually exclusive in the dominant culture's mind. And that so effectively keeps us from doing the work and the self-reflection that we need to do.
Yeah. I noticed in the introduction to your book, you talk about that first workshop you went to, mm-hmm. and it was like immediate, like one of the first things was like, raise your hand if you're a white racist. Like, do you still do that today? Like, do you feel like that's like an important first step? Like, it's just all say here that we're definitely racist, you know, and then move forward from there.
No, I don't. I haven't found that white people can handle that. That may be the punchline that I get to, but if I open, you know, come out of the gate with that, they're not going to be able to hear it. That's why I have to build that foundation and help them move towards what racism means from a social science perspective, right? I understand that in mainstream culture, a racist is someone who has conscious bias towards another race. And in the mainstream understanding, that means anybody from any race can be racist. That, from a social science perspective, is actually the definition of prejudice. Everybody has prejudice. Anybody can be prejudiced. We're all prejudiced, okay? But when you take a group's collective prejudice and you back it with institutional power, it's transformed into oppression. And then that group is able to impact the entire life of the other group at the institutional level. So the example I'll often use is asking when women got the right to vote, which was 1920. And then I'll ask, who gave it to us? Men. Okay. And outside of a violent revolution, which I'm not condoning, is there any other way we could have gotten the right to vote except for men to give it to us? No. Why not? Because we literally were not sitting in the institutional seats of power. That does not mean women could not be empowered or have personal power or even be mean in, you know, localized interactions with individual men. But women could not systematically deny men the right to vote. Women could not give themselves the right to vote. And even if a man agreed that a woman should have the right to vote, he still benefited from the system that denied it. That's the difference between prejudice, which everyone has, and racism, which is a deeply embedded historic direct relationship of power.
Mm-hmm.
So when I say I wouldn't say is everybody racist until I've laid that down, and then I have to be really careful because even if I led with that, I wouldn't say everybody's racist. I would have to say all white people are racist.
Oh, right.
Now, I'm nervous even saying that on the radio because if someone takes that out of context, they lose their minds. But they have to understand that my definition of racism is different. If I had their definition, I might not say what I just said. But that is not how I understand racism. That's why the woman asked the question. Most people raised their hand. I did not raise my hand, right? Because I did not understand her to be asking what she was asking.
Right. What you heard is raise your hand if you're a bad person.
Exactly. Yeah. Or if you have conscious hatred or prejudice towards people of color. And at that point, I didn't even know what implicit bias was, right? But most bias is unconscious. And that's what makes it so difficult is if it's unconscious and then we refuse to try to examine it, we only hold it in place. All this defensiveness only protects our blind spots.
Yeah.
I thought of another thing that an analogy that I use that helps with the defensiveness. I've learned to just be really proactive, and at the very beginning of my workshops, just kind of do a few things that can help bring the defensiveness down, because I don't want to argue about racism, right? I'm coming from racism's real, it exists, it's 24/7. It's in forms that are explicit that we would probably all recognize, and it's in new adaptive forms that many of us wouldn't recognize. But I'm not going to argue about that. That's the premise I start from. And so I'll use the example. If you were going to take a class on Marxist theory, you would not be required to come out of the class as a Marxist, right? But you would be required or expected to grapple with Marxist theory, gain a basic mastery of it, and be able to apply it to a set of problems. That's what you would be asked to do by the professor. And so anti-racism is a theory, it's a framework and an approach, and I'm only asking you to be willing to grapple with it, try to understand it, try to apply it to a set of problems and see what you can see that you can't see now. When you leave the room, you're free to put your other glasses back on. And that kind of frees us from this whole agree-disagree dynamic, which I'm at a point and I've got the confidence now. I just don't want to go there. I'm not going to do it.
I wonder if we could go back. I know that we're running up against, I've already gone a little bit longer than I said I would. But
okay. I'm fine. Yeah. I'm thrilled to have the opportunity to lay this out.
Oh, great, great. Well, I actually wanted to go back a couple of steps to something I heard you say earlier we talked about sort of maybe some strategies for how to have the conversation. You mentioned some things, some common sort of sayings that you sometimes hear or cliches that you sometimes hear that usually aren't helpful. I wonder if you could just lay those out, just sort of say, what are some things you hear a lot from white people when they talk about race and that aren't helpful, that we should sort of look out for in our own conversations.
Okay. So I take this up in chapter 13 in my book, and that chapter is called Common White Narratives That Deny Racism. And I kind of go through all of the ones that I'm familiar with. So in no particular order, I'll start with, but the real oppression is class. And I grew up poor. Nobody gave me anything. I worked hard for what I have. Now, what I have going for me when that one comes up is that I grew up poor, profoundly poor. And so I have some legitimacy there, that in the same way that white person to white person, you know, it's harder to deny me when I'm talking to another person who grew up poor. I don't get all bound up in the kind of the guilt a middle class person might get bound up in. And I'm clear as a bell. Yes, I was poor. Yes, I knew I was less than. I was seen as dirty and lazy. I felt a lot of shame in my childhood, and I always knew that I was white and that there was somebody under us, lower than us. And I believe that poor white people use whiteness to realign ourselves with the dominant white culture that our poverty separates us from. I'm also really clear that although I pushed that barrier up the hill, I actually have an image of a Sisyphus in my slideshow, and the Sisyphus is pushing two big boulders up the hill, and one says sexism and one says classism, and those are my boulders, right? I had to push sexism up the hill because as a little Catholic girl, you know, I was taught to be silent and passive and pleasing and obedient. And none of those patterns set me up to speak out about racism. And classism, which was you're not smart, you're not going anywhere, right? You don't belong. Those are huge boulders I've had to overcome. I'm the only person in my college in my family who's gone to college. And I have a PhD today, but I got that late in life, right? But there's another huge boulder I never pushed up that hill, and that's racism. And it's the draft of other people pushing that boulder that helped me get mine up. Because white privilege, now that I'm here, I belong. I belong at that faculty meeting. I belong in front of the class. You would not know. You are not reading me through the lens of class. You would not know that I grew up poor today. And Barbara Smith is a scholar activist who has a wonderful quote. She's an African-American woman. And she says, "You give me any situation, you put some color on it, it'll be worse. You're poor, be black and poor," right? I don't really know how a white person can deny that to be white and poor and or to be black and poor is not the same and that it will be harder. You're a person who uses a wheelchair, be a black person in a wheelchair, right? And you're going to deal with ableism and racism, right? I did not ever have to deal with racism. And that freed me up. It freed up a lot of psychic space, all kinds of things to allow me to navigate those class barriers. So that's one common one. Race doesn't have any meaning to me, or I just happen to live in an all-white neighborhood. I had a student put it like this once. I was really lucky. I grew up in an all-white neighborhood, and so I never learned anything about racism. And so sometimes I'll say that in my workshops and ask people, so what are the pillars under her peer, right? What are the structures that she uses to understand what racism is that would allow her to make that statement, right? And so one, we can see that she saw her all-white space as racially neutral, right? It's just a fluke or an accident. There's no race in an all-white space. She learned nothing about racism. And probably the most clever perversion in that statement, again, not conscious, but that if she was lucky because she missed out on that terrible thing called racism because there were no people of color, then who has racism and who brings it to whom? Right? So it's people of color that have race and also those problems with race. By being able to identify how she's making meaning, what is the framework she's using, then I can start to dismantle those frameworks, right? That's what I try to do in my workshops and my class. And the way that is set up, remember I said when I started, you have to kind of do the building blocks. You can see that I had to cover socialization for her. I had to cover all of these things to lead her to a place to understand that she was profoundly shaped by that segregation. I don't know. Since you have the chapter in front of you, can you prompt me with a few of them?
I don't have the chapter in front of me. I have the okay. Amazon preview in front of me, which just has the chapter title.
Okay, let me think. Yeah. Tell me ones you've heard, because I'm sure I've heard them.
Well, the ones you mentioned earlier were, what were the ones you said before? I don't even remember. I recorded them. But you described them more as like just cliches that people just sort of say, let me tell you what we need to do, that kind of thing.
Right. Another one, really any sentence that begins with people just need to is, one of my pet peeves, right? So people just need to, and I think we can all fill in the blanks, get along, get over it, stop talking about it, not see color, all of those really meaningless platitudes. And so what you have to, the way I would respond to is, the way I would respond is, there is no objective reality. We do not see the world through objective eyes. It's not humanly possible not to judge. We're all judging all the time. And much of that is not, we're not even aware of. And so we have to go under the surface and try to identify what we've internalized if we're going to challenge it. Mm-hmm. Let me think. You know, none of this is easy, right? I don't have the answer. As you can tell, that if the more time I have, the more open they are. In these one-on-one interactions, it's kind of difficult. Sometimes I will ask a pointed question such as, so tell me how you've applied that to your own life. Do you have relationships with people of color? Do you have many? What groups are they from? Are they long-term? And you can ask a series of questions that'll start to unravel that. It will also start to get the person agitated, because now you're scratching up against the very thin veneer, right, of our defenses. So I'm not sure that you can do a lot in an interaction like that, but you can try. Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, I think that, I feel like I could continue talking all day, or at least listening all day. Is there anything else that I hadn't gotten to yet that you want to make sure that we talk about?
I'm just thinking, I feel like I really got across to you, right? I mean, I spent a lot of time at different points in the interview around, we've got to stop seeing racism as a good, bad proposition and see it as a system. And we have got to have humility in the face of our inevitable investments and blind spots. We have to kind of let go and just be in that place of not knowing. And we also have to build our capacity to bear witness to the pain of racism for people of color and to the pain that we invariably cause. Like, those are some of the strategies. And so that's why you can see it's really deep work. That one-on-one conversation with that person who says people just need to. I might not, you know, when people say, just tell me what to do, it's like, well, I'll tell you, but you're not going to like it because it's not easy. It's not quick. It's lifelong. This will not end in my lifetime, and I will not be finished in my lifetime. It's ongoing. And maybe I would end with, although I do anti-racist work, I don't call myself an anti-racist white. And I don't call myself an ally either, or a white ally. And that's because it's for people of color to decide if in any given moment I'm behaving in anti-racist ways. I'm the least qualified to make that assessment. And that reminds me to be humble, and it reminds me to be accountable. And it also reminds me that it's something that is demonstrated in practice. The words are meaningless. I need to demonstrate that I am an anti-racist or engaged in anti-racist work. And that's something that's a verb, not a noun. I might have done a good job yesterday. I got another job ahead of me today. It's not over.
Right. And like having like a nice interaction one day doesn't get you out of like, okay, I've got some anti-racism behind me. I can just chill for the next week.
Yes. And even our ideas that like what it's about is a nice interaction, right? Kind of reveals this idea that if we're open and nice to people of color, right, then we're not engaged in racism. Racism comes out of our pores as white people. It's the way that we are. And I have actually begun to think about it as the most hostile dynamic for people of color is unexamined whiteness. It's the unexamined culture of whiteness. So we want to get more people of color in our workplace, but we are not examining the whiteness of the workplace, and it's toxic for people of color. So I'm really confident that I do less damage to people of color than I used to do. That is what I can say to you. I do less damage than I used to. And there are a number of people of color that do consider me to be an ally to them. I could not have said that to you before I started this work. And I could not have said that to you without years of this work. But I can say it today, and I'm committed to maintaining it and growing it.
Got it. Okay.
So I'll end with that. How's that?
I think that'll do. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Support for State of Opportunity comes from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, a partner with communities where children come first.